What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, an affiliate of Mad in America Radio, broadcasting on KBOO in Oregon, sponsored by Portland Hearing Voices and the Icarus Project, and syndicated on the Pacifica Network. Madness Radio is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio and at madinamerica.com. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is George McCouch. George is a psychiatrist trained in Jungian analysis and process work. He's in private practice based in Central Oregon. George is the author of the recent book, While Psychiatry Slept, Reawakening the Imagination in Therapy. So welcome to Madness Radio, George McCouch.
Thanks, Will. Great to be with you.
Yeah, welcome to the show. I'm very excited about your new book, While Psychiatry Slept. There's a lot that I think the listeners are going to be really interested in, and especially in your work with what gets called psychosis, your understanding of shamanism, your understanding of the meaning in altered states and extreme states, and your real effort to try and get psychiatry as a whole to step back from the more mechanistic neuroscience brain-oriented reductionism that often happens. So it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you. I love the way you said that. I'm going to have to write that down. I love the brain-oriented mechanism. That's exactly right. It's way too much that way right now.
Yeah. So why do you think that it's too much? What would be the sort of the devil's advocate would say, hey, we have all this new science that's coming in, neuroscience, brain imaging, you know, the therapy and psychotherapy for psychosis or people with schizophrenia or a bipolar diagnosis, that's kind of in the past. That really now what we need is these new approaches. And what would you say to a devil's advocate approach question about that?
You know, let me stay semi-scientific for a second and say, you know, I was always trained in what's called the biopsychosocial model, that there may be something biological that you have to look at, something psychological and something sociological, system-based. And what's happened now is everything, there's such a push to the biology of it that when you see a lot of these writings and people say, well, this is the scientific or this is the evidence-based, what you find out is that they've become so blinded by those set of glasses they put on that they'll disclude other data that's so compelling that if you're truly being scientific, if you're truly willing to look at what's going on, then you have to include this other data, which often is the amazing psychological things that you have to work hard to not find the meaning in. For instance, I mean, right away in the book, I tell about working with a woman going through an extreme state, and you could make cases for the biology of it, of course. And she was in a hospital at that time, and we're sitting there in the office. She had trouble in her life where she had came from a very religious family. Her father was a minister, and he was very against her doing anything but giving her life over to God. And when she came in to see me that day, she had begun to have a relationship with a young man and said at that time to me, if she was pregnant, she was going to keep the baby. Now, this was a huge thing for her. And just as she said that, there was a blue jay that hit the window we were sitting by. And I had an office that was in the back of the hospital, way out in the field, no trees. I'd never seen a blue jay or any other bird there. And this blue jay hit the window, and then it hit the window over and over and over again. And I said to her, right at that second, I said, what do you know about blue jays? And she said, they steal the eggs from the nest and kill the babies. And I said, what was happening just as that happened? And she said, I had a thought that said I was evil if I had a baby. Now that, you can't disclude that if you're truly being scientific. And when we began to then work together on how we called it Blue Jay Man would come and steal her and come in with those thoughts and try and steal her real feelings, there was a huge change in how she did.
So So this is the data that you're saying that science, if to be truly scientific, needs to listen to. There's something with her very religious father being against her having a child with this this man she was having a relationship with.
Yes.
And that's, it makes me think of one of the things that caught me right away in your book was that the first thing you talk about is a dog named Boomer, and my mom's dog is named Boomer. So I thought, okay, well, that's a very interesting synchronicity there. I'm going to explore this. And and so I like that, George, that the idea is not to be rejecting of science or anti-science, but actually to kind of call out leading and mainstream and dominant science, because it's not scientific enough. It's not actually taking all of the evidence and all of the data, because it may be that if a blue jay hits the window and behaves in this very unusual way and it has real meaning for a patient, then wait a second, what's the so-called official normal scientific explanation for that? And we don't have one. But guess what? That's what nature is all about. There's a lot of mysteries in nature. And I think to actually be scientific, you have to be open to data that doesn't fit into established theories or schema, because it's there in nature. It's actually evidence. It's data that you can't ignore. And that, I think, is one of the biggest tragedies of the emphasis so much on neuroscience and the brain and the kind of chemical causality view, is that it makes a claim that science knows more than it actually does, and that actually life, especially human life, is filled with a lot more mystery and meaning than science wants to admit.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things that I say early in the introduction, as I say, you know, I'm not trying in this book to just overthrow what's been done. And there, you know, certainly I've seen things by working as a psychiatrist that have been quite useful. But I, you know, one of the points I make is I say, you know, even though there may have been progress, that there's really what I say in the book here is, however, in my opinion, all this process has had a dark side, or at least a parallel development heading in the wrong direction. As the age of the brain revolution has captivated psychiatry and its training and residencies, a corresponding loss of soul can be increasingly witnessed. Young doctors emerge from training steeped in the latest biochemistry and DSM diagnosis, but without exposure to dreams, the history of psychiatry and psychology, great literature, the body and its connection to the psyche, or any idea of alternative ways for viewing symptoms except through a prism of causality. That's one of my big complaints, is that it leaves out the art, it leaves out all the aspects of soul, and it's not trained in. And so as a psychiatrist now sits and sees somebody, they only look through that prism. They try and squeeze people into diagnostic categories even when they don't fit, because they have no other way of seeing it.
I think that is a very much true of the human crisis in general, that we've proceeded with this technological advance, but the dark side is a loss of soul, and it's affects mental health, it affects healthcare in general, it affects everything about how we live. And so I think what's beautiful about your book is that you really get into the detail of what would it be like to bring soul and story and meaning back into the center of what it is to be a healer in the mental health realm. One of the things that's striking about your book, and I think it makes a lot of sense to me, is that when I was doing my own clinical training, I was encouraged and, you know, basically required to write up these case examples. And it became very clear to me very early on that there was no way that I could do that in any kind of objective way, that they're really what these cases were are stories that I'm telling, and that it reflects as much my own creativity. And so I've always backed away from giving kind of, you know, case stories as if it was some kind of objective. And so that's what you do in the book. And I think you talk a lot about the people that you work with, but in a more general way as stories and examples. And it points to the fact that if we go back to Freud and Jung, that actually the practice of psychiatry is very strongly rooted in literature, in philosophy, in the study of the world's religions, because this is what we need if we're going to actually address what it is to be human and what it is to suffer as a human. So tell us a little bit about story and why you chose to take a storytelling kind of approach in your book and in your work, and why is that important?
There's a great quote from Hillman in Religion, a book called Religion is Story. And he says that he has seen that children who have a connection to story and fantasy and reading stories and their parents help them with story seem to emotionally be much more grounded as they get older, that there's a sense that great literature and fiction is really the way the soul talks, the way this middle realm that is the realm of imagination and fiction and metaphor is really the way that we connect in the world. And it keeps it more fictional. The psyche is always trying to fictionalize things. It's a very, very interesting thing. A lot of people don't know that in PTSD, when patients come with the objectified, horrific dream of the trauma, that over time, the way you'll see that they're getting better is that the dreams now become more and more fictionalized, more mythic. It seems as if that's what's trying to happen all the time, is that the stories are moving in that direction.
So break that down for us a little bit more. In trauma, you're saying that there's a fictionalization process, or there's a storytelling process that evolves in the psyche as part of healing. How does that happen? What exactly is that about?
It seems that the psyche itself is always moving towards fiction, that as it moves closer to imagination and fiction, that's also when healing is occurring, when people can step away and start to see, I'm caught in this figure or this, or the dream world seems to move it more into imagination and less into the literal aspect of this is what exactly happened, versus it moves it more into the imagination. And that was discovered originally by Harry Wilmer, a great Jungian analyst down at, he worked down in Texas, and he had a whole ward for Vietnam veterans with PTSD, and he discovered that, and then it's been written about more. And I've seen that not just in PTSD, but in what we'll call extreme states or psychosis. Things are very fictionalized, very imaginative in what comes up. And then people call that psychosis rather than seeing it as an altered reality that moves in that direction. For instance, I talk about some other psychiatrists in the book that have written in this kind of storytelling fashion, and I say that they've mastered a genre of fictional case histories by embedding their psychological wisdom and methods in their writing. In this style, simile and metaphor, image and sensual character are sought, and the cold abstractions of the scientistic are eschewed. The great Graham Greene, the great writer Graham Greene, thought that this allows for literal memories to come out not as journalism and purported fact, but by being thrown into the compost heap of time, they're altered into the deeper truth of imagination.
Yeah, I would say that definitely the arc of any healing trauma is really about the stories that we tell about the trauma and then our role in the trauma. And that's really what you're doing when you're sitting with someone and talking and bringing in different aspects that may have been excluded or blocked out or too overwhelming, that starts to come in. And the body plays a really important part in generating this. And there's always this sort of frozen quality at the beginning, or even an avoidance. And then when the storytelling happens, and what you're describing is this actually is a creative process. It's a fictioning process, but it's a fictioning that comes from the truth of some kind of soul experience that the person is having.
It seems to be natural to the psyche to do that and move it. And as it moves there, one gets more distance on and is be able to see the figures. And if we stay with trauma for a second, the horrificness of trauma and being the victim of it, it's a huge thing. I'm not downplaying that at all. But as a person starts to move in any kind of therapy, what starts to happen is that they are able to move into what are the more marginalized figures. They start to see that they're not the only being in their psychic house. And as that happens, that's when healing is also happening.
They may remember the story a little bit more fully, and oh, there was a figure or a person that was actually a positive element, or there was something that I did where I wasn't just a passive experiencer and victim of this trauma, but there's something that I did was actually had power or agency. And so the story starts to reflect an actual healing process. And so you're saying what I think actually a lot of neuroscientists are now saying, which is that storytelling and creating story and the fact that the memory is a creative process and not some kind of like data entry, you know, photography of some kind. It's actually memory itself is creative. Neuroscientists are starting to say that we are storytelling animals, that that's at the very core of who we are. And you're pointing out how that storytelling quality is really at the core of healing and has to be part of any kind of therapy with people to help them with their emotional, psychological struggles.
Yeah. Storytelling Animal. That's one of my favorite books by Jonathan Gottschall.
And so therapy is really more art than anything. Medicine is really more art than anything. Would you agree?
100%. And I talk about Bernard Lown's book in the chapter that I wrote on the placebo effect, and an incredible book by probably the greatest cardiologists of the last 100 years.
Now, this is a really important book. Can you tell us the name of this book? Because when I discovered it, it just resonated so strongly about how to do medicine in a different way.
The Lost Art of Healing by Bernard Lown, L-O-W-N-M-D.
And it's kind of considered a classic, although now it's a little bit kind of falling by the wayside.
Yeah, it really is a classic. When I was teaching psychiatric residents, at the end of each rotation, I would give them that book as a gift because it's so fallen away in the teaching. But it's an amazing book. And again, see, affecting and going into the imagination from a standpoint of the placebo and how words can heal. And that's an amazing, everyone should read that book.
One of the things that is the heart of his message is that healing is about listening, which I think is going to resonate with the Madness Radio listeners, because that's really the message of what we're trying to get across in Madness Radio, is that we have lost so much of our capacity to listen, to connect with each other. And so tell us about the bedside manner that you discuss in your book and the placebo effect and how this all weaves together with listening and storytelling.
Well, Lown does a great job in just saying that the listening is more, the art of listening is about hearing and seeing all that's going on. Story after story of Lown is about him noticing somebody's signal, looking the other way, or hearing a change in the voice drop, or
listening not just as a conveying information, but actually being present to all the different, the body, all the things that are happening, the nonverbal.
Exactly. If he and I were talking, I would be talking about that these are all the conduits, these are all the channels that the soul can enter from, or that basically the dream world is entering from. And he discovered that more as a cardiologist and had, you know, just he's got story after story of when he followed those things, you know, wonderful things happening independent of what he was doing with medication.
So we think of cardiologists as like, oh, your heart is a pump and it breaks down. And so the cardiologist just takes a look at it and goes in there and fixes it. But actually, no, that's not. We're saying that in medicine in general, listening is actually central. And how does this relate to the placebo effect? And what are maybe some examples of the power of this? Because you write in your book that words can heal. And I know this from my own experience, because when I was told you're schizophrenic, those words injured me. And then when I start to claim different words, I feel like the word and that identity and that story is a healing experience. So tell us more about the placebo effect and how that fits into this.
As you're moving in the process of life and your psyche's moving in this more fictionalized way, if you get off at a station called schizophrenia or a station called depression or a station called anxiety, that word literalizes and fixes right in time the way you start to see it.
Like it freezes you in an identity, and the identity itself becomes part of the problem.
Exactly. Exactly. And so this idea of fictionalizing things, you've got to get back on the train. And so when I see people and they come in, they tell me depression, I say, well, Depression is a word that describes experiences, but it's abstract. Let's go into yours. Now you're into the individual. And that's what Lown does in his book also. He's going into what's the, yeah, you say you have this and this, but let's go into the individual thing about what you're feeling or thinking. One woman in there says, well, will the cardioversion that you're going to do to change my arrhythmia, will it help my back pain? And Lown says, oh, of course it will. Now, there's no scientific evidence that it will, but why not do that? It's not going to hurt her. And the resident that was with him, right with the woman, the patient said, oh, that's absurd. He got in a fight with Lown. And Lown said, Lown chewed him out later. But anyway, the woman's back pain got better. You know, why is that? Same thing. The most incredible story he tells in that book is when they went in to listen to a patient, a whole group of young doctors with him, and the patient had what's called an S3 Gallop. Now, that's a really bad sign in cardiology. That often means that the person, his heart is completely failing and they're going to die. But this young student said, oh my God, listen to that gallop. And a day or so later, the patient was checking out of the hospital, and Lown only found out the story later that the guy said, when the patient or when the resident, young resident said, oh, listen to that gallop, I thought, oh my gosh, my heart is really strong. It's galloping like a horse. What am I doing in the hospital here? And he lived like 2 years ongoing after that before he finally passed.
So he was told something positive about what his heart condition was, and then actually got internalized and actually served a healing function for him. Now, this is something that's unique, you know, to humans and living beings. You don't send your car to the shop and like there's a kind of a sudden unexpected. But actually, if doctors are honest, they don't have control over the situation. There's all kinds of unexpected twists and turns, including unexpected healing. And in the mental health recovery world, we talk about being strengths-based. So you're not just focusing on the problem, but you're also recognizing that there's always strengths here, because those are words that now come into the person's story, that they do have strength, and then that actually has a strengthening and healing. And so give us an example of how that has played out in your own work.
Let's say an average, you're getting a placebo effect at least at 38% or 40% response rate with placebo. And in medicine studies, you only have to beat that by a couple percent, and you only have to have two studies that beat that to get it approved by the FDA.
So you're saying that for a drug to get licensed and to go onto the market, it just has to be better than placebo, but actually placebo is actually really effective, and it just has to be a little bit more effective than placebo to say, oh, this is the drug that's helping you.
Exactly. So from just one standpoint, as a physician, you want to use all that placebo effect. You want to be not going, oh, the drug is a little better than placebo. You want to go, can I get all that effect from the placebo? So the stories that you tell, the way you watch the client, how many doctors are suddenly going to their computer and writing the script, or they're looking down and writing the script and they're not watching the patient. Let's say when I'm prescribing or have prescribed medications, the most important time, the absolute most important time for me to be watching is when I say, well, you know, with this, I've had some luck, let's say with Zoloft, but now I've got to absolutely watch that person, because right at that moment, let's say they sit back, take a breath, I see them look down and they say, okay, I'll try that. And then I watch that signal, like I said that Lown would do, and I call that out and I bring that out, and they go, well, you know, I didn't really want to use Zoloft, but I'm going to, you know, you're the doctor, but, you know, my sister had a suicide attempt when she tried it.
Just reminds me of the very first time that I took an antidepressant drug. This was before I was in the hospital and before I went through that whole experience, but I started taking Prozac, and I remember my decision. I wrote in my journal that it was definitely a giving up experience. It was almost like a suicidal thing that I could feel like, okay, I don't care anymore. I don't care. Just give me a drug. And, you know, that was a big part of the meaning of that drug for me was it was very destructive in a lot of ways. And I think that a lot of times people who have positive experiences with medications because of the mindset that they bring in, you know, it has a meaningful, I mean, you quote Hippocrates. I think there's a very famous quote from Hippocrates where it's the patient's belief in the goodness within the doctor that actually is what provides some healing.
And these things are way under trained now. I mean, I've been teaching for 40 years and there's nobody that comes in really understanding about placebo or what's also called nocebo, which is the negative effect with the mindset like you just talked about with the Prozac. And all those things make a huge, huge difference. And there's no training in that. There's no training.
It used to be, because we're kind of talking about something broader than pills. We're talking about something like bedside manner or
yes.
the presence
yes.
of the
yes.
healing, listening presence of the soul attendant in a sense. I think that's what psychotherapy means. So, and there's no training of that anymore. It's actually dismissed. It's seen as noise. It's just statistical noise in our technological pursuit of these pills as machines.
I tell a story in the book of being at a major worldwide conference for child and adolescent psychiatry, and there's a major researcher said that they were having a 75% success rate with Seroquel for kids with bipolar disorder. But the problem was that they were having a 73% success rate with placebo.
That was the problem.
And that's what she said, but we got to figure out how to get the placebo effect to go down so that we can get the medication approved by the FDA.
Right.
And I remember running out of the room with my iPhone and dictating like, oh my God, I got to remember this.
Yeah. Yeah. Because we forget that it's not just a pill. It's the attention. It's the listening. It's the expectation. It's the ceremonial ritual of going in to a doctor. It's the encounter with this powerful person with all this science behind them. It's the entire array of everything that the person has ever read on the internet or in the media. A pill is actually a meaningful event. It carries stories. It carries all kinds of symbols. And it's not just a technological or chemical factor in someone's brain chemistry. George, both you and I have been very influenced by the work of Carl Jung, and I was just wondering if you could just explain a little bit, why is Jung so significant in what we're talking about? Because when we think about placebo and bedside manner, and we don't necessarily think of Jung, but Jung is actually very central to what has formed your own thinking about this. So can you tell us a little bit about why Carl Jung is important?
You know, to say why is Carl Jung important, I get caught also just in my personal, there's a way he was so true to what was happening, so true to what was coming up and looking at it, and not, even though he came out of being born in 1875 and coming out of the whole time when things are moving towards enlightenment and mechanism and Darwinism and that whole direction, he somehow was able to be absolutely true to the imagination and the psyche and the dreams and deeply go into them. When he went into his own confrontation with the unconscious that's so beautifully written about in his biography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, and had broken away from Freud because he didn't believe that dreams were just about causality and that he came to believe and says very clearly, I didn't any longer have anything. I didn't believe what Freud was doing. I didn't believe in the way those dreams were being interpreted. So I started to see my patients, and I was just open to what he called Gessenlauschen. What was there? What was naturally happening? And then he said, I would give it Betrachten, which is in German, means to give it special attention. And when you did, it would become pregnant and begin to move. And that was also then when he was going through his confrontation. So he began to do this amazing 16-year experiment where he wrote down his fantasies and he went into them, and he went into them so openly with such imagination. One of his great, great sayings is, treat us as if we are real and listen attentively to what we say. That's what he would say that the figures from the unconscious were saying. And he would know, yes, this is imagination, but at the same time, it works, it's real, and I have to listen as if it's real.
So there's a deep, deep listening that Jung brings. And remarkably, you know, his early work was with hospitalized people diagnosed with schizophrenia and psychosis. And he named the very dilemma that we're in now, which is, you know, seeing the problems as just brain problems and having a kind of a medical model. He was already talking about that.
What he wrote then is still ahead of the time now. And that's 100 years ago.
One of the things that Jung did is he would listen very closely to the stories and the fantasies and the wild ideas and visions that people who were so-called psychotic were having, and he would believe that there's meaning in there, that there's a reason why this is happening. And that's also been part of your work. Tell us about your work bringing this kind of deep listening and this storytelling framing. Tell us about your work with people identified as psychotic or identified as schizophrenic or having some other mental illness diagnosis.
I got started with that in the late 70s when I first met one of the premier writers on it, John Perry, who had studied with Jung in the late 1940s and came back, and he was one of the original people that started the Jungian Institute in San Francisco, and he opened up a facility in San Francisco called diapasis, meaning crossing over, that there could be a way to work. And he had amazing success. And I read his books, The Far Side of Madness and Roots and Renewal and Myth and Madness, and also Jung's writing. And I really believed that when I was open to listening about that and not just automatically seeing it as a pathology and medicating it right away, that there was something there. So I actually, in my fourth year of my residency, did a research project of working with acutely extreme state or psychotic patients off medications with just psychotherapy. And I always have been open to that since, and have continued at times to work with people even in my private practice with that, often though they're often medicated. But so back when I did that experiment and research thing, I remember a young woman coming in and being in that break, and I remember seeing her out in the room standing next to a table that the two other patients were playing cards at, and she was making all sorts of body movements. So here would be a way of doing something completely different. I walked out to see what was going on, and every time they put down a card, she went to a different body movement. And I realized that she was taking on the identity within her body and herself of the card. So whatever she did, I did. And then she would look at me and she would do another one and I would do it. And then I would start to change my body position a little and lead her. And she started to take my body positions until I took a body position of reaching out with my hand, and she grabbed my hand and I walked over, and then we were able to talk about what was happening. And that was at a time I was doing a lot of reading. And I remember the great psychiatrist Pinnell had taken the chains off people with extreme states and psychotic episodes, and they were keeping them in cages and in chains and feeding them like dogs. And Perry had taught me that in the midst of an episode where the patient goes into the unconscious, they lose their identity. They're in what would be called the limen. They're between doorways, between rooms, and stuck in the doorway. They've lost one identity but haven't taken on the new one yet. And in that place, they're looking for their new identity. And that's what this young woman was doing. And we were able to talk about that and how fearful that was. And
so you were able to establish a connection and communicate with her by using and listening to and using the language she was using, which was this body movement language. And it sounds like she had been very isolated and wasn't connected with other people.
Yes.
And so you were able to kind of create a bridge to her reality just by noticing rather than ignoring or pathologizing or trying to suppress this, you know, admittedly strange, you know, mysterious behavior that she's doing.
Right. Because you're starting with the premise that it's the reality she's living in and what's happening is real and it needs to be gone into more rather than automatically just turned off. I often taught, you know, turn up the radio signal to find out what it wants before you automatically turn it off.
Right. Or just assuming that it's static and you got to fix the cord or get a new, you know, transistor or something. There's a chapter in your book called Animal Eyes. And I think it's especially interesting because, you know, the danger of psychiatry so much is that in its technological view, it becomes a kind of colonialism. It becomes a way of saying this is the only way of looking at the world, and religious or spiritual or ancestral or indigenous views are just kind of antiquated, and that's not really. But really, shamanism is a very living reality for not just for people with indigenous backgrounds, but for all of us. And that's, I think, at the heart of what we're talking about, is that seeing things from beyond a technological view and starting to really recognize that there's something deeply ancestral and deeply spiritual in all of these healing crises.
Animal Eyes, boy, that's the heart of the book. Alignac is his name, or his Christian name was Alex. Alignac was an imagination I had in working when I worked inpatient psychiatry for about 10 years in my career. What if an indigenous person came in the midst of this? Like any of the people coming in, there was meaningful things that were happening, and automatically then you were trying to take them to court or told you had to take them to court to put them on medication. So I tried to imagine a story now in this time, imagined up in Seattle where it would be near, you know, possible, the Inupiat culture, that somebody came in who had an ancestral background of having a great-great-grandfather who was a shaman. And certainly Jung and many other people talk about that ancient cultures are often hooked to ancestors, and that plays up through part of the unconscious. And so I imagine this story of what if that happened, and what if the mother thought, oh my gosh, is it my grandfather that's coming up through him, and is he having a spiritual or more religious experience or a calling to shamanism? And if you read Michael Harner's book, or especially if you read Mircea Eliade's book on archaic techniques of ecstasy and shamanism, you'll see that, you know, people are clearly having what you could call breakdowns and changes in their whole identity, and often they're cutting themselves and all sorts of things.
As part of the initiation process.
As part of the initiation process, or the indication that they're called to be a shaman.
Right, the calling, and then the process needs some help and support that then comes from the culture.
Yes. And then we, you know, but we lock people away and try and put them on drugs right away. There's no sense of the milieus anymore available to treat that, except in very limited places anymore. The diabasis is closed, Soteria House is closed. Mm-hmm. You don't have these options. So I imagine this situation of the possibility of psychotherapy with this over and against a much more open psychiatrist, over and against the antagonist who's saying, look, all the scientific literature says that you're actually hurting the person. And that really is where things are at now.
Right. If you let them continue in their so-called psychotic state, it's like a fever that's eating away at their brain. It's this untreated psychosis that it's actually harming someone to allow them to go through this journey. That's how regressive and backwards we've come on this.
And that's seen as, you know, this study shows this and this, and then the other studies that show something different are thrown out. And that's one of the things I do in there, is try and make it a dialogue in the story of showing the competing studies that are left out, that are very good studies, very well thought out studies that are left out in modern times because they don't fit the direction that the people are trying to claim as the only absolute way to do it.
Yeah, the neuroscience view is not a consensus. It's a dominance. It's not a consensus. George, previously you said that you had someone you worked with for many years, Marnie, who really brought all this to you and really showed this to you. Can you tell us about that?
Let me read a little bit about talking about her. It's in the case of in the story of Animal Eyes. I tell about how I wonder this as the imagined psychiatrist. Thomas Harper is sitting there. He says, how could Dr. Melman, a young, gifted doctor who knew next to nothing about metaphor and symbolism, how could this be when this crucial aspect of training disappeared from psychiatry's teaching menu? As I enjoyed the sauna's heat penetrating every pore and the wonderful smell of eucalyptus on the rocks, I remembered the incredible case of Marnie from years ago. She was a great example of the healing patients need from a physician with a therapeutic ear, trained to hear the music of simile and metaphor. I can remember the call from the hospital. We have a 50-year-old Caucasian female with psychotic depression, the social worker said in too cheery a voice for an early Monday morning. She still can be delusional, but we have to get her out of the hospital because of the DRGs, which are the what's happening now in hospitals or diagnostic related groups. They say you should be able to treat somebody and get them out of the hospital in this long a period of time.
If they're in this group of people because of the statistics and the studies and everything.
Exactly. So if you treat them with medication and they're psychotic or in an extreme state, you really should be able to get them out in 4 to 7 days.
Right. It's all algorithms. And actually, it's all moving to artificial intelligence and just technology doing the whole thing for you without even a human involved. But that's another discussion. But
so I agree to work with her, and her first session was memorable. And she's dressed in jeans. I go on with that, and she's on some medication. And slowly, in the standard history taking, we get to the heart of her story. She told me that about 4 to 6 weeks ago, she began to think that cars were stopping outside her home and taking pictures of her residence. She felt that they were police or FBI, and that they were bugging her phone. And as she went on, she often stopped and said, I know this sounds crazy, but it seems so real. I assured her it was important to hear all the details and that I felt in the end I could help her make sense of her thoughts. This seemed to reassure her, and she went on telling me that she thought that they were after her for smuggling drugs across the Canadian border. She blushed and said, I've never done that. I'm not a drug addict. But then she became more visibly upset and said, I'm quite worried about my husband is in on it. I think he was also bugging my phone. He's a very devout Christian as I am, and I was sure he felt I was sinning and not being a good Christian wife. We began to talk about her relationship, and she said it was great, but she had an overwhelming sense of guilt. I decided to make a move in the unusual direction for her first session and began to teach about her delusion. I told her one way to look at it is that she was having a waking dream and to view the material symbolic. We talked about the inner versus outer life and questions she might have, and she was surprisingly open to this and said she always believed in dreams. What if the FBI and the police were opinions and parts of her that were against certain other urges and wishes, and therefore she had to smuggle them across the border? She would come in to see me, and she would come in and say, therapy's stupid. And she'd say, your lips snarled the last time. And then we'd go into that and find out what was coming out of that. And the smuggling across the border turned out to be that she had to smuggle. The drugs became metaphorical for having to smuggle all her needs that were always pushed away, and that she would be seen as weak. So all her delusional, so-called delusional aspects were a waking dream. That is the thing that's never thought about before. Just like the woman that's making the movements in the out in the dining room that I told about at the table. In these extreme states, it's the dream world has come alive outside in the world. And Marnie would teach me that all the time, although I knew that she'd come in and she said, my dreams are alive out in the world again. You know, I saw this cane at the doorway, and it meant this to me. And when we would go into it deeper, we'd get the meaning in it, and she would be relieved. She would come in and she would say, Her husband had me see her in an emergency after we'd been working for a while because she was trying to walk her dog, but was sure there were people shooting at her. But when we were able to go into this, it was linked how her dream world was alive because her mother was always taking pot shots at her. Every time you could make the connection from that, you built a bridge back from the unconscious back to the conscious, and she, now you were back in the day world and you were able to talk more about it.
And so this is someone who's having these potentially hugely overwhelming experiences, and unless she can get a hold of them in some way, she can get some kind of meaning or some kind of understanding, it's just going to drive her deeper and deeper into crisis. So it sounds like you were able to help her to maybe continue to be in the community and avoid so much hospitalization and have some relief and peace.
She got completely well.
What do you attribute that to? Was it just her reduction of her fear, or was it actually something deeper?
I would attribute it in her case to unbelievable amounts of courage and willingness, that she really came to believe in therapy and really came to believe in the unconscious. And so she was very opening to exploring even the scariest things. And slowly over time, she integrated it. There's lots of stories about her in the book. And one of them is that there was a figure called the bowl cut girl. I talk about it in there, that when that bowl cut girl became real and she could really start to listen to it and what that figure wanted. There's a great saying by Hillman sometimes is, I want to know less about the meaning of an image and more about what it wants. What's the figure want?
Right, like a character in a story.
Yes. And the more we listened to it, she then started to make a relationship to this part of herself and wasn't just caught in it. And as that happened, it was the bowl cut girl that was needing to smuggle things across the border because nobody ever listened to her. So she always had to smuggle all of what was imagined as pills to help her pain and suffering. But the more she listened to the bowl cut girl about what her pain and suffering was and got to know her, then all that other compulsion went away and the psychosis never came back.
I think that's an interesting way of thinking about meaninglessness. Like if you're in a situation where things seem meaningless, that you're not sure why they're happening, it's going to fuel a sense of powerlessness, that you don't have control. There's no power. There's no agency. And then that, I think, is so much at the heart of why people spiral down, is that they lose a grasp on life. They lose a sense of agency and control. And so we can sort of think of meaning as just like, well, it's just symbolic. It's just about interpretation. No, it's about having a sense of empowerment and making sense of your life so that you can actually live your life. It's absolutely crucial. It's not just some additional interpretation when we talk about meaning. It's about having a sense of where you are, locating yourself in your reality.
You know, R.D. Lang, the amazing psychiatrist from Scotland who did Kingsley Hall and worked that way, you know, he has an incredible chapter in his book, Politics of Experience, called The 10-Day Voyage. And he asked the person what they needed. And they said, I needed a sheet anchor. I needed a connection that someone knew or understood or could be connected with me. I'm in an age range back of studies of LSD. In fact, I went and did some workshops with Stan Grof back in the early 80s at Esalen. And it was clear that set and setting made a huge difference. If you were with a sitter in an LSD experience that was very positive, you would have a positive experience from it. And if you weren't, you wouldn't. And Jung says very clearly, just in what you were just saying, that the biggest problem in psychosis is that if the person is met with the sense that they're still understood, that they're still connected, that there's a sense of meaning, that there's a sense of being connected with and understood, then oftentimes they can come through it. But when they lose that and in the middle of it and they don't feel that connection, then they go into a panic, and the panic itself is the thing that then drives it.
Absolutely. I mean, I interviewed Ethan Waters, who talked about the sort of global situation with mental health diagnosis. And we talked about how in some cultures around the world, someone goes into a psychosis and it would be diagnosed as schizophrenia, But in that culture, it's considered meaningful. They have an expectation you're going to get through it. We're not going to cut you off. You don't have to be separate. It's completely normal. It's completely accepted. It's dangerous and scary and overwhelming and painful, but there's a context of meaning, and that creates a holding and an expectation. And that's what actually gets people to have better recovery rates than if they were just tossed into a hospital and told that they were schizophrenic and take medications. And then that set and setting creates the expectation of just a chronic state. So I think this is really at the heart of it, is really, are we expecting experiences to be meaningful? And are we able to communicate and relate to that meaning through listening? Because if we don't have that attitude, in some ways we've dehumanized the other. We're saying we have meaning, but you don't. We're connected and empowered, but you've got this different thing going on. And so you're not quite like the rest of humanity. George, you said something earlier that we hear a lot in Jungian psychology is this idea of integration. And what's your definition of integration? How would you understand? Because I think that's kind of what we're working towards when we're dealing with extreme states and psychosis, is to have some kind of integration of these experiences. But how would you kind of define it?
I probably, way back when, imagined as you integrated it and it became more of your ego or your identity. There may be still aspects of that, but I see it more now as relationship, that it becomes dialogic. The conscious has more of a relationship and listening to the unconscious. Say, like in the Marnie example, she starts to have a relationship to the bowl cut girl as one of the figures in her soul, and they can now have dialogue, and she is open to listening more to that, but also having a push back against it or back and forth. And that the dialogue opens up rather than I'm supposed to be just this one thing and everything else is a symptom or something bad and I have to repress it. So I see integration now more as an aspect of relationship.
So having a relationship with something rather than running away from it or being just purely dominated by it or just shutting it down or not listening to it, trying to engage with it with actually in a dynamic way. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you have a good relationship. It can be kind of a wrestling match and a struggle and a battle, but at least the relationship is happening and there's an engagement there.
I talk about in different places in the book a book by Mary Watkins called Invisible Guests.
Yeah, I remember you mentioning that in the book, and I got very interested in Mary Watkins.
Mary Watkins, amazing, amazing woman. And she wrote Waking Dreams years ago and then wrote Invisible Guests. But in Invisible Guests, she tells, and this is the heart, I think, of what is really misunderstood in treating extreme states, is that automatically it's seen as a weakness of the ego or weakness of the person, and so they're swamped by their unconscious. And the idea with medication is to give the medication, seen as biological. And basically what you do, if you ever really talk to the people in the midst of these states, I mean, if you're a psychiatrist or a psychologist and you really talk to the people, they'll tell you with the medication that all she did is flip the switch over again. The voices or the figures, they're still there. They're just numbed out more. They're just medicated more. But there's no cure in giving antipsychotic medications. It's a palliative treatment that just flips things over. Now, in some people, maybe that's what has to happen. But the gist of what Mary Watkins starts to have to say is, let's look at these figures and see that they're not filled out enough. They don't have enough animation. She totally turns the whole thing on its head. And she says, you have to get more into what do they want? What's their belief? And so it becomes deeper and you've got more of a clear figure and more of a clear figure of what your eye would want. There's a story I tell in the Jung's Lament, where the character begins to work and notices a sense of dizziness and just a little bit of pulling in the body. And so I help them stand up and follow what would be called a symptom in medicine. just like hearing a voice can be called a symptom. But what if you start to fill that out and unfold it, like you're saying? What if you add other aspects to it? Well, what happens is a character starts to come out of it, just like you're working with Stanislavski in pulling a character out for a play. And so in this one instance, I start to work with this person. I have them pick up this little sense of dizziness and this sense of pulling, and we bring that out. And it was pretty wild. Suddenly, this patient, they go to the floor, and they're overwhelmingly sobbing. And I help them to stay in it and to follow it. And as they do that, their legs starts to drag and their face is contorted, and we start to bring that out more. And as we bring that out more, there's an aspect of saying slow, and they come up and they begin to rub their head against my leg, and they want their head petted. And this figure has come out of just the teeniest little body symptom. And that figure was trying to come up from the unconscious, had been repressed for so long. And now the psychotherapy started to work and be in connection and relationship more to that figure. And what did it want?
So, George, it sounds like art is really at the center of the perspective and approach that you're taking. Is that right?
Yes. The sense that though we have science and psychotherapy, that psychotherapy at its core essence is art. And that's what I really have come to believe. And, you know, there's a quote from Freud that says, "Everywhere I go, I find a poet has been there before me." In about 1917, Jung had a voice come to him from a woman that said, "What you are doing is art." And that's a lot of what my paper Jung's Lament is on, is that he now has come back as an ancestor saying, you know, I didn't believe that enough. And what if that was the case? And so I say in my book, and this is a way, and as we're getting near the end, it seems as though we have come to the end of our conversation, at least for the present time, Jung responded. I want to say that I'm happy you've had this experience. I'm speaking of the feeling realization of the reality of the psyche. It is one that is crucial, and in the end, sadly, one that very few people have, even therapists. The Red Book taught me this. My experience there showed me that I must take seriously every unknown wanderer who personally inhabits the inner world, since they are real because they are effectual. In the end, the real is what works. I'm glad to have taught you this, and that you heard the soul's yearning, her longing to be taken seriously. You also heard my lament, and through our discussion reconnected me to the alchemists, the deepest roots of my work. I can hear them saying, what nature leaves imperfect, the art perfects. Now I understand what the soul was saying to me so many years ago. She was not looking for the literal scientific truth, as I was, but her interest was in finding the artistic truth. Her intent was to reshape the literal truth of the world into the forms that reveal the deeper universal truths of our existence.
George, we're just about out of time. Remind people the name of your book and also how they can get in touch with you.
My book is While Psychiatry Slept, Reawakening the Imagination in Therapy, and you can get it at your local booksellers or online. I'm working in private practice in Sisters, Oregon, and I have a website called Central Oregon Psychiatry, and you can connect to me through my website.
George McCouch, thank you so much for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure, Will.
You've been listening to an interview with George McCouch. George is a psychiatrist trained in Jungian analysis and process work. He is in private practice in Central Oregon. George is also the author of the recent book, While Psychiatry Slept, Reawakening the Imagination in Therapy. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Madness Radio host is Will Hall. Producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio is an affiliate of Madden America Radio, broadcasting on KBOO in Oregon, sponsored by Portland Hearing Voices and the Icarus Project, and syndicated on the Pacifica Network. Madness Radio is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio and at maddenamerica.com.